Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I am Renee Komen, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Klempire with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man.
Hey.
What is going on with you?
Holy moly, Manny. Well, you know, so we take 1 week off and all hell breaks loose.
Oh, yeah? What happened?
Oh, you know, I had the follower of ISIS, Islamic State, had a big terrorist attack there in the French Quarter.
Oh, when was this?
Nightmare.
New Year's Day, 3 o'clock.
Yeah. Holy moly.
Now, were you out there?
I was not. I was at home.
Okay.
I was at home in my backyard with my sister. And
at 3 a.m. you were in your backyard?
No.
The
3
hell goes on at 3 a.m.
At 3 a.m. I was asleep in my bed, but New Year's Eve we were back there, put a fire in the fire pit, built one back there, drinking some wine. My nieces were over there lighting sparklers, so it was a quiet New Year's Eve. How about yourself?
No, I had some... I had some family. My sister was in town to call. Her and her family were in town for the Toilet Bowl, which was the game between the Raiders and the Saints.
Right.
And the Raiders won.
I know. I saw that. I was happy for you, man.
The Raiders won. It was a great game. And I got to rub it in all those Saints fans.
Yeah, I was thinking the Dome must have, you must have been enjoying.
Oh, yeah, we were enjoying
it. Dejected Saints fans.
Oh, yeah, we were just giving it to them. And then we walked down Bourbon Street with all the other Raider fans after the game and giving it to them there. And the funny thing was, it was like 4 o'clock or something, and the lighting was really kind of weird. So my wife kept taking pictures of all the old architecture there and stuff with the lighting and stuff like that. And then we got home, had some dinner, and we started my wife wanted to show the pictures, so she started posting the pictures on the TV. We were looking at them. And one of the photos, there was a guy walking by who looked just like the terrorist bomber.
Huh.
He looked exactly like him.
Huh.
So we gave it to the FBI.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
And they told us to fuck off. It's our investigation.
Really?
Yeah.
Mind your own business?
Yeah. We don't need your help.
Huh.
You fucking local.
Huh.
So anyway, but he did look a lot like him. Now, I don't know if he was him or not, but... it wouldn't surprise me because the guy was there...
scouting the location.
He was there months in advance,
right.
Putting coolers down.
Well,
no one picked them up. Sitting there for months.
Well, no, I think...
Nobody picked up
the coolers. Went down that night. No, he was scouting October 31st.
October 31st?
Yeah, he was driving around on a bicycle and... Looking at he came here once before.
So was
apparently.
He in costume on October 31st?
I'm not sure. I don't think he was. I think they have.
I think
footage.
He was probably dressed as Spider-Man.
Okay, well,
you think
that's one you can't really tell if you're dressed as Spider-Man.
You know,
who knows
coolers
who's in there.
With homemade bombs.
Oh man!
And we talked about homemade bombs last week.
Somehow, coincidentally, we were talking about the anarchist cookbook. You know, it's funny. I mean, that was all way before any of this happened.
Do you know that anarchists can cook really good pies? They cook really good pies.
I heard the show.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty good stuff. But anyway, so that happened, and everyone, you know, and I got a bunch of shit a few days after for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because...
people thought you were being insensitive, like you were...
Well, I said, you know, everyone's saying they're safe.
Uh-huh.
Everyone's going, they're safe. I'm safe. So I said, I'm safe, but I'm not well.
Sure.
You know, and everyone gave me a bunch of shit for that. You know, I don't give a fuck. Anyway, you know, so... But I thought it was a pretty funny joke, you know? Our friend T. Ben Boudreaux liked it.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. Well, he's
So that happened, and now the president came down. They had this huge mass, whatever. And
you know, I actually played on Bourbon Street last night.
Really?
Yeah. I was afraid it was going to be packed or difficult to get in because of the president. And they had the last night was 12th night of Christmas. So the first night
of Christmas was
King's Day yesterday, and so the beginning of Mardi Gras.
Christmas is over. How can you have a 12th?
Well, it's 12 days of Christmas. On the 12th day of Christmas is King's Day, and
so when is the first day of Christmas?
Christmas.
So the 25th.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't need to get into the math. I know that yesterday was 12th night, and therefore the...
So what happens in 12th night? Well, you're an ex-Catholic. Tell me.
It's the beginning of Mardi Gras.
Oh, yes.
It's the beginning of the carnival season, I should say.
God.
Mardi Gras is, sometime down the road. But
the worst season ever.
So
Paul, when I become mayor, I'm getting rid of Mardi Gras. That's my first thing.
Dutch Morial,
new president, he wants to call the Gulf of Mexico... the Gulf of America.
Yeah,
did
I saw
hear
that
about
tonight.
That?
I saw that.
But he spelled Gulf, G-O-L-F. Stupid fucking idiot.
The Gulf of America.
Yeah, that's what he did. But he seems like a good guy. We'll give him a shot.
Well, you were. I know you were disappointed by him in his first term.
Yeah, he was a big disappointment.
Maybe it'll turn out better this time.
Yeah, so we'll see what.
I don't have a lot of confidence.
You know what
he wants?
He says he's going to take the military down to take over the canal in Panama. Did you see that?
Huh.
He's going to use military force.
Wow.
You know, good luck with that.
Yeah. Not advisable.
Yeah. So what happened? You were playing down
there?
Well,
yeah, so I played down there, and actually the place I was playing was one of the locations of one of those cooler bombs that they had out.
Oh.
No, I mean, it had nothing to do with me, but it just goes to show you, anywhere you go down there, it's right.
It's a horrible place, the French Quarter.
Well,
never go there.
Certainly was that night, man. God damn.
Oh, God, yeah.
Holy cow.
You know, so much for safety. And, people are trying to sue the city and the NOPD. Good luck with that.
Yeah. That's
you're
a
not
going to
get away with that.
Well, and then now, of course, they're concerned about the Mardi Gras season coming up and the potential for terrorist actions.
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Okay, but saying we're going to put all these policies into place. Man, if somebody wants to do something, during Mardi Gras, there's so many people. There's no way you could stop. You can't cordon off the whole city. I mean, you'd have to have
martial law.
You know, you have to rely on people being reasonable. You know, civilized.
No, I mean, with all the little crews, the sub-crews and the crews.
And there's
and
tons
all these
of pedestrians everywhere.
Yeah,
so, you know, you
those, they're the worst. The pedestrians are the worst.
Well, you know, I don't know.
Let's just get rid of them.
They have a right to walk around.
But, so good luck with that, LaToya.
Yeah.
You know, she asked Biden, I think, to give the level one for Mardi Gras.
Yeah. We're going to have a lot of federal resources coming in.
We're below sea level, so we're below all that.
Okay.
Yeah, no one's going to. Who cares? I don't care. I'm not going out there.
Right. You typically don't go to a lot of Mardi Gras parades.
One or two that my wife drags me out to, and people think we're a married couple. I've been there, done that. Who needs it?
Right.
You know, but my daughter was out there in the French Quarter about an hour or so before that shit happened.
Really?
Yeah, she was out there, but she was way on the other side of town. She was at a rave.
Oh.
You know, somewhere else.
Really?
So she's okay.
MDMA or something?
I don't know what she was doing.
Sure. You don't ask those questions. I wouldn't either.
She's 5'4" of power.
Okay.
And strength, and she can knock me out if she wants.
Yeah.
She has. She's a good kid, though.
Sure, yeah.
I still don't think she's mine. But
she looks just like you.
You know, I don't know. That's... We'll see. My wife just giggles when I say that, just like you did right now.
Yeah, there's a pretty strong resemblance, I would say.
Except for the beard.
Well,
she has a beard and I don't.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know how you feel, Manny.
She's a good kid. No, she's 3 years now with her same boyfriend.
Oh,
they're doing well.
That's
they're
nice.
Planning a trip to somewhere. I don't know what they're going to do.
Okay.
They seem like good kids.
Yes.
They come to visit.
Right on.
They say, Poppy, pay me. That's basically their whole thing.
Well, for Christmas, did you have to write a bunch of checks?
Yeah, I wrote a bunch of checks, as always.
Well, that's
good. I had family in town from California, so there was extra checks I had to write, you know.
That you had to write or they had to write to Selena?
Well, one of them was to me to keep me away, you know. But they're good kids, too, my sister
and
her family. They all seem good.
Yeah, I think my wife somehow met your sister at some point.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I was, you know, it was one of those weeks where I had to do things, you know. I just wanted to stay home.
Had obligations.
I had obligations.
Sure.
Because this trip was planned months in advance.
Right.
But I got some good meals out of it, so that's all.
Okay.
You know.
Well, I had something happened. I had my annual physical with the Troubled Men podcast staff physician. He asked about you, inquired as to how you were doing.
While he was giving you the rectal exam,
well,
he said,
you know,
how's Manny doing?
You know, this reminds me of something, Manny. How's Manny doing?
Yeah, exactly.
Something, Renee. Well, no, actually, you know, as we talked about the last few years, I think he just wants to be friends now because I don't even have to take my pants off for this thing. You know, I just take my, you know, go down to a t-shirt.
Well,
and he,
here's what it comes down
no,
to.
No, I know. They use the blood test.
It's all about the blood.
Right.
It's the blood. Just give me enough blood and I'll figure out if anything's wrong with you.
Well,
and
so they say.
Yeah, you know.
I'm not so sure that I have full confidence in that.
Well, I don't have full confidence when he says, whatever you're doing, Manny, keep it up.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's what he told me. Yeah, he said, keep doing what you're doing. And I said, are you sure? Do you know what I'm doing?
Yeah, do you know what I'm doing, doctor?
He's a good kid. Yeah.
And he's got a kid in college right now, or two kids in college up in Michigan, I think.
Huh. I never inquired.
One's at Michigan and is into majoring in some kind of agriculture thing, if I think. I can't remember. But, so it's getting the service. I don't know. I only go there in August, so I don't know what the service is like. But usually I get the first appointment of the day, you know, 8 o'clock. I'm the first person.
Huh.
They still don't see me till like 8:30.
Yeah.
You know, what's that about?
I don't know.
You know. Just, I think he doesn't show up until like 8:15, 8:30.
Just want to make sure that you're there.
Right. And then they have some assistant, a nurse. You know, they weigh you. They give you the blood pressure. And they ask you questions.
Right.
And then he comes in a few minutes later. He asks me the same questions.
Yeah.
So I just told the nurse this. Are you an echo? You know? It's like...
Well, she's the warm-up act.
Yeah,
and
she's the warm-up act.
He comes in to close, you know, close out the show.
I think maybe in the next physical, I'm going to go there the last appointment and see how he treats it.
Okay.
You know? Because I need some doctor's notes. I might see him earlier.
Yeah, he might be in a hurry to get out of there, go make his rounds.
I don't know. Anyway, I had a bit of a fiasco last night.
Oh, okay. Go on.
Well, you know, we're having this freeze and all that, or very cold weather. Yeah, I'm sure you know all about this cold weather.
Oh, yeah.
You live here. And me and the wife are cuddling and we're sleeping. We had the heaters on a little bit. And of all nights for this to happen, the smoke alarm in our room starts chirping.
Sure.
It's like, fuck. And you know, we have those high ceilings.
High vaulted ceiling. Yeah,
high vaulted ceilings. And it was like, fuck.
Do you have a ladder that gets up that high?
I have a 6-foot ladder.
Oh,
it's
Jesus.
Up about 10 and a half to 12 feet, the alarm. So I run at 3 a.m. I'm in my pajamas. I put my robe on. I put a jacket over my robe, and I have to go to the shed in the corner of the backyard to get this fucking ladder up. We move the bed. I'm 5'8".
Right.
On a good day, because, you know, my posh.
Sure.
And I'm reaching for this smoke alarm, and it keeps chirping, and I'm like about a foot and a half away to a foot of reaching it. And we're trying to, like, with a thing, to knock it down and stuff. Like, and we're fucking, you know, sleepy and tired and cold.
That's a good way to fall off the ladder and really hurt yourself, Manny.
Well, that's what my wife was doing. But then all of a sudden she started playing some game on her phone while I was up there. I don't know. Anyway, I have this idea. I said, let's scoot the bed all the way against the wall. We'll remove the mattress. We'll put the ladder on the... Because our frame is like a wood frame. It's one of those movable beds, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's very sturdy.
Three Stooges type shit here.
Well, you know, you want to get some sleep, man.
Sure.
So we put the ladder there. I get up there. And I remove the battery. Let's take the battery out. I said, oh, God, that's so good. Walking down the ladder, chirps again.
Right.
It's like, what the fuck is this about?
Yeah, it's got its own little power supply, huh?
Well, I go back up there, and I squeeze the reset button, and it just, it sounds like a fucking porpoise dying.
Oh, you wrenched all the
power
all the from extra
it.
Juice out.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I said,
well, that was smart.
Yeah. And I took the ladder, put it on the back porch. We moved the bed back. We got back in bed. And of course, my wife says to me, I wonder if there's any live wires up there. It's like, well, I don't know. Why are you saying this now? So I'm up for another 2 hours thinking that, you know, something's going to catch on fire.
Oh,
you know, but of course, nothing happens. I fall asleep around 5 a.m. I have to wake up an hour later.
Right.
I'm tired, and it was just the worst day ever. I'm at work, and, you know, school starts next week, and there's questions being asked of me, and I'm going, what? Just like, I have no, hello? You know.
Okay.
Yeah. Como? Como? You know, and I'm on these Zoom calls with corporate people, and they're asking me questions, and I decide, because you have to put yourself on camera in these Zoom calls. I decide my camera doesn't work. So I just told them, my camera's not working. Yeah, I'll answer your question the best I can, you know.
You had your head down on the desk.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, it was my head down on the desk, you know. You know, dreaming of me on a street corner going, miss. Anyway, so that happened.
Oh, and, man. Well, I'm sorry.
Just,
sorry
I'm
about
so
that.
I'm tired. Oh, okay. Basically, I'm pretty tired right now.
All right.
Now,
well, you see, you got a full head of steam. So
yeah,
it's,
well, because I'm going to drop. Okay. I might just crash into a tree on the way home.
Oh, geez. Oh, let's hope not. Let's hope not. Well, I have one more thing I wanted to mention to the Troubled Nation. You remember a while back, maybe last year sometime, they had this documentary crew in here doing a little short film.
Oh, yeah. This fucking
movie,
amateurs.
Movie
yeah.
Deep Dive. So,
yeah.
So they put the short, I think it was originally done as a sort of treatment to try to maybe get a longer show where they go around and go to different dive bars or something.
So they made a pilot, hoping
they made a pilot. Yeah.
Someone would pick it up.
So they put the pilot up on YouTube, and there's a lot of us on it being interviewed. A lot of Dave Clements, Juan, all the luminaries here at the
and the
Snake
critics
and
called it everything from shit to fucking shit.
Okay,
that's what they called it. Now remember, we were talking for like 10 minutes to camera,
right?
And then the director goes, "Oh, we're not even rolling."
Oh, yeah, I do remember,
remember
that.
It's like, well, fuck, I just fucking gave you tons of great material. I'm not going to remember that.
Right.
Stupid fucks.
Well, they did have some good quotes from us there. And,
oh, yeah.
So I'll put a link to that YouTube video in the
like
show notes of this show.
Yeah,
so everybody can check that out in the show
and
notes
all those
there.
They were Tulane film students, weren't they?
I'm not sure where they were from.
They were Loyola or Tulane.
Yeah, they seemed about that age.
Now they're all working at Trader Joe's.
Okay. That seems like a good company.
Yeah.
I hear good things.
I used to work for Trader Joe's in high school.
Oh, okay.
It was my after-school job when I was a junior and
right
senior
on.
In high school.
That's
it's
how
a good
you,
gig.
That's how you got that retail experience.
You know, and there's always good-looking women at Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
You know.
Shopping there or working there?
Both.
Okay.
But these days when I go to Trader Joe's, they're just freaks. They're out-of-work filmmakers.
Sure.
With tattoos and beards.
Yeah. That's a lot of those going on.
Yeah. Anyway, do you go to Trader Joe's at all?
I've not really. Even though my parents live right behind the one on Veterans, so I'm often in that neighborhood. I'm just not in the habit of going there. And
it's really good for something.
That's what people say. They have certain products.
Beautiful, great
that,
things, yeah.
That you can't get anywhere else.
Because if you go to Whole Foods, it's like a whole paycheck, basically.
Right.
You know, so fuck them.
Yeah, Trader Joe's is more reasonably priced,
oh,
and they have
yeah.
Specialty
they got,
items like
oh,
some
yeah,
dips or candies.
And frozen stuff.
Oh, okay,
like frozen
foods.
Dinners are good at.
Oh, okay.
And they're a lot cheaper. They're just cheap.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do it.
Yeah.
Shout
volume.
Out to TJ.
Volume.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we should get our guest in
sure,
here.
Sure, he's been quiet,
yeah,
which
yeah,
is
yeah.
Kind of weird because he usually talks my ear off.
Well, maybe he's saving it up.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
I was given explicit instructions.
No, okay. I said you please feel free to talk, comment, all that stuff. Anyway, we won't relitigate that part of the instructions. Anyway, we have a terrific guest tonight. I've known him for many, many years. We only kind of started really getting to know each other personally in more recent time. I'll explain all that, but he's a terrific award-winning songwriter, singer, guitar player, producer, actor, film worker. He's a founding member of the band Cowboy Mouth. He's a leader of his own Rolling Road Show with over 20 solo records released and a number of collaborative projects. People like John Boutte, the Wright Brothers, and also wrote the New Orleans-themed musical Nine Lives, a musical story of New Orleans with writer Coleman DK based on the Dan Baum best-selling book. We're going to get into all that and much more, but without further ado, the great Mr. Paul Sanchez. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, fellas. Thanks for having me. I've been enjoying the podcast.
Man, right on.
Cracks me up.
Right on.
Always did.
Yeah, man. We Manny cracks us all up. Well, Paul, so yeah, I was mentioning that, you know, you and I have known each other for 40 years or known of each other for 40 years. We've never played really in a band together. Did one or two odd gigs here or there, but very briefly. But in more recent years, we've gotten to know each other because we wind up in these social situations because your wife is in a social group. It's sometimes referred to as the Troubled Wives Auxiliary. There are other names
I know the name.
I'm with the troubled men because I was a troubled boy who was waiting to be a troubled man.
Sure.
It took me a lifetime. And I think that musicians meet in two places. They meet either when they're working together or when their wives get to be friends.
Yeah, okay.
Because, I mean, what do we talk about? You're standing at a party, you could know a guy for 20 years, and unless something comes up about music that perks up your ears, you kind of just stand there going, what did I come here for?
Right. Yeah. Look, I remember being at, like, when my kids were in school, and you'd get invited to social events with parents of their friends. And I remember standing in the room and being frozen because everything I would think of to say, I would think, don't say that, Renee.
Right.
Don't say that.
Right. No.
So people wind up thinking, oh, Renee's a snob or something. But really, I'm just terrified to show you who I really am because you'll be horrified.
Well, first of all, you're like, none of us picked up an instrument because we were happy.
Sure.
And none of us picked up an instrument because we were already good at being social.
Right.
It was a way to, first of all, be happy. Secondly, find friends.
Right.
You know, so once you take the instrument away, then you're just a guy at a party who doesn't know how to make friends.
Right.
And doesn't really have much to say.
But so anyway, and this includes Manny's wife as well. So it's all three of our wives are in this the social
group.
Well,
I've known Manny's wife since she was a kid. I mean, her older brother was a harmonica player with me when I was 19 years old.
Okay, well, that's what I was going to say.
She was literally, like, I guess, 15 years old back then.
Right, so you go way back with Manny's in-laws.
The whole family, yeah.
Right.
They're a great bunch of people.
Now, is that from, they're from Reefer Ridge. Were you hanging out at Reefer Ridge,
out there? I met John at the Beverly Dinner Playhouse. We were both waiters when we were 19.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Now, Beverly Dinner Playhouse, that's not in your bio, but that,
I should have put that in
I'm
my
really
bio.
Interested in that.
Oh, so,
well, Marion also was like a hostess.
She was a hostess. Yeah. And my wife, Allison, was a waitress there as well.
Wow. So what shows did you see there? They, like,
oh, my God.
They had, like, Bob Crane would come in.
Gary Berghoff, Radar O'Reilly, who was a great drummer, by the way.
Dinner Theater.
Yeah.
And also there was some old, you know, Hollywood, like Larry Linville, who played.
He was there.
He played Frank Burns in MASH.
Right.
And apparently when he went on stage, his opening scene, everyone booed him because he was
a hated character.
He's a hated character from MASH, the poor guy.
Right.
You know,
got to meet some you know, interesting people and the plays. But my favorite story of those days, besides, you know, they had a great piano player, Freddie Palmisano, who's not with us anymore. But
Freddie
would play after the shows were over, and it was me and Mary Vergara, all these really people that people that would go on to be singers and stuff. And so Freddie would play for us while we all got drunk at 19. Because the drinking age was 18 back then, you know.
Right,
but,
right.
Mostly, you'd like it was a 19-year-old and up crowd. And there were waiters, I mean, you know, musicians and actors. And then the busboys were all high school guys. Now, on Wednesdays, they would bring in old folks from the old folks'
right,
homes on
yeah.
bus. And the busboys couldn't work a matinee because they were in high school.
Uh-huh.
So you had to bus your own tables. And it would get to be pretty hectic. You know, you were really hustling. Like, and the
old folks... And those seniors are difficult.
Man, they came in, they would line up, and they would...
Who do you have to stoop to get soft butter?
Well, they would open
here,
up their purses, and they would have their purses lined with
yeah.
foil.
Yeah.
Load them up with food, you know?
So
you're bussing food, and you're cleaning up their purses for them, and so you're trying to bust the table as you're putting out drinks, and I come to this one table, and the lady is face down in her plate of spaghetti.
Oh, geez.
And her three friends are just chowing it, just chowing away. And I was like, what happened? And they just didn't even break stride. They were like, I think she passed out. And then I just kept eating. And I didn't know what to do.
You think?
So I went, well, can I have her plate?
Or maybe she dropped dead.
I said, can I have her plate?
Right.
And then so I wound up having to let the maitre d' know, and they called an ambulance. She had a heart attack.
Oh my God.
She went out on a stretcher.
Oh jeez.
Her friends
didn't miss a beat.
They kept eating. Man, because it might be their last meal too, you know.
I hear you, man. No, I was at a dance my father was playing, his band was playing, and there was an older crowd, and a guy did expire on the dance floor, and they brought the whole crew in, crash truck and everything, and worked on him for a while, and he was not to be revived, but they covered him up like they were going to go work on him some more. And my father goes over to the person that hired, said, so I guess you want to wrap it up. He goes, oh no, these people are used to it. No, you can go ahead and crank it up again.
You remember the Otha Turner?
Oh yeah.
Well, our tour manager from Cowboy Mouth, this guy Brian Barry, was Otha's tour manager too. And he was on tour with Otha, and at this time, he was like 92 years old.
Uh-huh.
No, I think Otha was 88, and his drummer was 92.
Okay.
So they're playing a show, and the drummer dies of a heart attack. And they sort of take him away, and Otha finishes the show. It's Fife Blues, and he finishes the show. And he's signing autographs afterwards, and Brian was standing next to him. He said, this woman walks up, she goes, Otha, I'm really sorry about your drummer. And he signs the autograph and goes, well, he was old.
Take it in stride.
Yeah.
Well, so Paul, let's go back a little bit. So you are a New Orleanian. You are from New Orleans.
New Orleans born, New Orleans bred. When I die, I'll be New Orleans dead.
I've heard that somewhere. So you come from a big family there in the Irish Channel.
Five brothers and five sisters.
Nice. And you're one of the youngest or the youngest?
I'm 10 out of 11.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were you farmers? Your parents farmers?
My father was a longshoreman.
Oh, okay.
But he died when I was five, so.
Oh, man.
It was
at
really
the Beverly?
I'm sorry.
No. He was on the dock. My mother really raised us, you know. My oldest brother, who's 84 now, he was an actor. And so he would come back from like Detroit and L.A., you know, with these stories of plays he'd been in and shows he'd directed and stuff. And it was pretty exciting when you're just a kid, poor kid in the Channel, you know.
Sure.
And, he got to meet George Martin, and I was a big Beatles fan. It lit me up. And when I was like in the fifth grade, I got a chance. I was the worst baseball player in the world. And they called me the strikeout king, and I didn't pitch. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right,
it was
right.
I was bad.
Right, yeah, okay.
And so when I was 10 years old, you had to try out for the team. Prior to that, they had to take you.
Uh-huh.
And so I tried out for the team, but I also got accepted into Trinity Episcopal School's summer program for underprivileged kids.
Oh, okay.
And you got to act and sing. And it was an easy contest. I got selected for the team, but I was like, screw this, man, because I sucked. And I did that, and that was my first time on stage. I was the Artful Dodger. And Oliver.
Oh, nice.
And I got to, you know, sing and act and wear makeup and costumes, and it was awesome fun.
And you were sold.
I was sold, absolutely. I knew I was going to, you know, like, I saw Paul McCartney sing yesterday on the Ed Sullivan Show when I was like five or six, and I have that memory my whole life. I wanted to be that guy with the guitar singing,
right.
You know? And then Oliver acting got in there, and actually when I moved to New York, like in 86, I moved to New York, and I audited some classes at the Lee Adler Studios, mm-hmm. And it was really interesting. But after three classes, they said, well, that's, you can't audit anymore unless you're going to do it. And I was terrified of the thought of acting. And so I did went back to the Village and did my songwriting. Years later, I met Michael Servers, who's a Tony Award-winning actor.
Right, right.
And he tells me he did the same thing. He went over to the East Village and played his songs, but he got freaked out and went back to the acting side.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And really, like, I got to act because of Treme. You know, they cast me as Paul Sanchez. And
stretch.
It gave me dialogue, so I got a SAG card, and then I got a few roles. But I was in an audition, and I just hated auditions, man. I was like, I did this one for Spike Lee, and right before I went in, this guy I knew slapped me hard on the leg and goes, well, good luck, give him hell. And it really shook me. Like, I totally blew the audition, because I was like, why the hell did he just do that to me? And so I'm sitting there kind of nervous, and these other dudes are waiting, and Manny's there. I go, hey, man, how you doing? And he goes, all right. What are you here for? And we were, of course, different roles because he's, you know, he's got experience. And I said, well, I don't really like auditions. I get kind of nervous. And it was so cool, man. You were like, why? I've been doing this since I was a kid. Let me tell you, that guy's just a guy with a job. You go in there, and if he likes you, he likes you. What do you care? And he's just totally relaxed. It was like the first time I ever started thinking of auditions as, what do you care? It was a great line to walk away with.
Well, I'm glad I gave you that lesson, yeah, because it's a 30-second bit. You got 30 seconds to either please them or not please them.
It was a great lesson.
Yeah, so basically what you do is just go there. You can look at those sides all you want. And here's another thing. You walk into that waiting room and you have an idea of what you want to do. But then you sometimes, 90% of the time, you walk into that waiting room and everybody in there doesn't look like you. So either you're the part or you're not the part.
Okay.
Because there's many times when you walk into those waiting rooms and go, I don't need to be here. I'm not going to get this part.
You said that too that day, and that helped too.
Yeah.
Really, it was a great help to me.
All right, Manny Chevrolet. Yeah. Well,
also, go back to the Beverly really quick, because I was trying to remember the story of my wife. When, you know, they had these actors who were A-list actors in the 50s and 60s come there, and they were C or D-list. My Marion's job one night was to babysit Ann Miller before the show.
Oh, wow.
Ann Miller,
Ann Miller, the dancer, who had gone kind of, she got a little off and maybe too much on the bottle. And basically, I don't know who your boss was, but they told my wife, who was 16, I guess, at the time.
Yeah, she was young. Said,
just watch her.
Oh, my God.
Just watch her. Don't let her go anywhere. Like, don't let her disappear.
Watching a toddler.
Yeah, well, yeah. So I just want to say that real quickly, and then we'll move on.
Right on. So, you get that first on-stage experience. When do you start playing music? When do you start playing music out, in front of people? First of all, what schools did you go to there in the Irish Channel?
I went to St. Alphonsus Elementary School.
Okay.
Which... it's funny, like, it wasn't until years later, like almost high school, where I saw a school with grass. Because St. Alphonsus was a concrete playground surrounded by a barbed wire fence.
Right,
it looked
right.
like a prison yard.
Sure,
really.
yeah.
But it was next door to the St. Thomas housing projects.
Okay.
Which, you know, it got really bad, of course, like a lot of American inner cities did because of crack in the 80s. But when I was a kid in the 60s, it was poor... Irish kids and black kids and Italian kids, just poor families.
Right, it wasn't open air.
Place to live.
Wasn't open air drug market or anything.
No, like the first time I got mugged, I was 6 years old. I was walking to St. Alphonsus Church by myself, and five other 6 year olds walked up and they said, "You got any money?" And I had a dime in my shoe to light a candle for my father, but I didn't want, but I kept it in my shoe because it was, rough neighborhood, that channel. Even back then, it was poor kids. And I said, no, I don't have any money. And four of them grabbed an arm and a leg each, and the fifth kid searched me and found the dime in my shoe.
In your shoe.
Took it and walked away laughing. And I went to church, and I lit a candle for free and prayed to Jesus to forgive me for lighting the candle because I got mugged.
Right on. There you go.
Pretty sure he did.
Yes. Yes, I think so. So where'd you wind up going to high school there?
Redemptorist.
Oh, okay.
Which is also right there in the channel across from the St. Thomas
High School. All Catholic education.
Yeah. I had 1 year of public school at Bonneville, but it didn't take.
Okay. All right.
We were still platooning back then. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember.
You know, there was one high school, East Jefferson High School. There's so many kids in Jefferson Parish in the early 70s. So East Jefferson High School had... a shift that went from 6 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon, and then you came in at 1 until 6 in the evening.
Another shift
of high
school.
A whole different school body, yeah. Like 1,500
kids.
Shift
of grades?
No, the whole student body, 1,500 kids from that, and then an entire different student body in the afternoon.
6 a.m.?
Two different high schools.
Yeah, how are you going to get there at 6 a.m.?
Because they had to fit two class
different high schools.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, to different, yeah, I remember when they were doing that.
They called
platooning.
It the platoon system, which meant that the one building housed two different student bodies, and they had to split it in half time-wise.
Right, right. Okay, well, you were better off not being in that.
Yes, I did that one, and it didn't take, and I went back home to
a dentist. So did you have the early shift or the late shift?
Well, the first semester had the early shift, the second semester had the late shift. They both sucked.
Yeah.
Because you're either there at 6 in the morning or you're getting off of school at 6 in the evening.
Right, right.
You know.
Well, so when do you start playing music? I was a
sophomore. My brother Andrew had gone to school in California for flute, but he also studied guitar as well. And he was a really patient guy. He also is no longer with us, but he insisted I learn I wanted to learn easy stuff because I really just wanted to sing. Uh-huh. All I ever wanted to do was sing. And he would say, I'd say, teach me something easy. Because I was a terrible student then and now. And he'd go, well, I'll teach you something easy if I can show you something complicated. So I'd get all mad at him. Fuck, man, all right. And he'd show me something complicated and make me learn it. And then he'd show me what I wanted, like the carrot,
right.
You know,
okay.
Stick.
Yeah, yeah,
and then, of
good.
Course, as soon as he left the room, I would only practice the complicated thing.
Okay.
Because I just hated sucking in front of somebody, you know.
There you go. You see, he had a method.
And so he taught me. And then by the time I was... I guess I was like either 15 or 16. I think I was 15. There was a place on Jackson Square called the Chart House, Chart Room, which is near Canal. This was Jackson Square, upper place.
Yeah.
Used to be a steakhouse.
All Dave right, brother Clements. Dave Clements, czar of the Klempire.
And
the Klemperer.
They had this act called Jim and Dave that Alison Young used to sing with when she was like 17 or 18.
Okay.
And Jim and Dave were going on vacation, and they needed somebody to take their place. They wanted somebody who was good, but not so good that he'd steal the gig.
Sure, yeah.
And it was
it's
my
a sweet
first,
spot. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It was my first gig, and I knew a lot of songs, and my brother was friends with, they smoked weed together, and so I got the gig, and I was good enough to hold the gig for 2 weeks, and not good enough so that I got it, and they came back, they
perfect.
Got the gig. But it was great. You know, I didn't care. I was 15, making money in the French Quarter.
Yeah, yeah, and getting reps in front of people, playing the tunes.
Absolutely,
and
man.
That's a good experience. That's called paying dues, Paul.
It was great. That went on actually to this day.
The paying dues,
dues portion of the career still continues.
Sure, sure. So the first time that I remember seeing you now, I must have been seeing you during the whole punk new wave scene in New Orleans at Jimmy's. I don't really have an exact
the Backbeats.
Remembrance. I remember the Backbeats, but I mean, must have been around like when the Normals were playing.
But I was like a terrible little gutter snipe. You know, I was the kid. By then, we had moved to Kenner, and I was just a real, I mean, I was a hey bra from Kenner, let me tell you. I'm not even making fun when I say that. I was.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I was not somebody you'd have been drawn to in the punk scene. I was... I believe you went to Newman.
No, I went to Ben Franklin.
Ben Franklin. Which is more intelligent than Newman.
But I went to any private school.
I graduated Redemptorist because every teacher had kicked me out of class because I was such a punk. And I had 2 weeks left of school, and the final teacher kicked me out of class, and the disciplinarian called me to his office. And my uncle had been assessor of that parish for 40 years,
okay.
So I'm sure he pulled a string.
Sure, sure. It doesn't happen.
And he called me to his office and he says, listen, if none of your teachers see you for the final 2 weeks of school, if you sit right outside my office and you don't speak to any of them, we'll let you graduate. And so Arthur Schmidt, whoever you are, wherever your family is now, I love the man.
Right
and,
on.
He let
Shout
me graduate
out to Arthur Schmidt.
Because the teachers really wanted me gone.
Nice, nice. The first time I remember seeing you play in a band was the Backbeats.
Oh, funny, yeah.
And so the Backbeats...
How old were you? Teenager?
I was when did the Backbeats start?
It would have been like 81-ish.
Yeah, 80-ish. So I was 18 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. in that band, you had the great Steve Walters, one of my heroes, the bass player from The Normals.
Yeah.
Great bass player, even cooler guy.
Yep.
You know, he's one of these guys that just, I imagine that chicks must really dig Steve, because he's got that kind of aw shucks, you know, big tall guy,
and he just rocked.
He's totally
sound like you're digging.
Totally, man, I'm telling you, he's one of my.
Yeah,
he was a punk rock bass player. I mean, back when punk was really about the, you know, the eighth notes.
He's and propulsive he,
one
player,
finger,
man.
He was a one finger.
Yeah.
So all that stuff was. He was like.
And you also had DeGeneres in that band.
He played keyboard and guitar.
Right.
He was not the bass player in that band.
Soderbergh make a couple of videos of you guys.
Soderbergh actually made a video of us, which is available on YouTube.
Huh.
Yeah, I've seen it.
He was working in an arcade on LSU's campus. His father was teaching at LSU. Uh-huh. He was a kid. And he was working at a video arcade that I used to play at before Backbeats gigs. And Vance knew him because Vance knows everybody always. And he said, hey, this kid, you know, do this video for us. So we did it in an alley near Rosie's on Chapultepec, with light bulbs as microphones and in black and white. It's actually really stylish. And then I think it took him a while to edit because back then it was film, you know. So he calls us up and he goes, hey, you know, I got the film. It's going to be $5,000 for the video. And I said, well, while you were editing it, we broke up. Actually, Vance moved to California and,
right.
and no more bands, so we don't have any money to give you for the video. And he goes, well, I can't give it to you unless you pay me. I said, well, I don't really have any use for it because we broke up.
Yeah.
So keep
and he goes,
it.
Well, can I keep it on my demo reel? I said, sure, good luck. And then about a year and a half later, I was working as a PA on a film in Los Angeles. And at the rap party at Tommy Tang's, I got trashed and I left. I'm walking down Sunset. And I look up at a marquee and it says, smash hit of the year, Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Yeah,
and he had used it on his demo reel and gotten...
Oh, man. Very cool.
Yeah. Which is why he was nice enough to let me put it on YouTube. He sent me a nice copy to put on YouTube.
Nice, nice, nice.
Yeah. Well, he actually used Cowboy Mouth in a movie he did called The Underneath, which I think was his third film. And it was a film noir piece set in Austin, and he wanted to help us out. You know, we had run out like our second record back at the time.
Right.
And the movie tanked, and the next movie he did was Aaron Brockovich. And he did an interview for Langyap where he said, you know, I think this is going to be a big hit. And the guy said, well, did you feel the same way about The Underneath? And he said, no, not really. I kind of knew in the middle of it was going to be a disaster.
Yeah.
And so I emailed him after I read it and said, next time you know you're making a hit.
Yeah, use us.
Put me in it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, this seems like a good time to take a break, man.
Yeah. Paul, we usually take a break. The Troubled Nation knows what to do. We'll be right back.
Standing at the bus stop, just across from Krause, and I'm waiting for that driver to take me to my heavenly house, and I'll see you there
at the foot of Canal Street.
What will he wear
at the foot of Canal Street?
What will the band be playing
at the foot of Canal Street?
What will the people be saying
at the foot of Canal Street?
Is your father loved? Does your mother flowing, and the streetcar has seen its day? When all is gone, the plantation's hallelujah, the Tremé and the Bucaré. You know, I'll be swinging to that music on a higher ground. Well, Pops is blowing walk on, up the gable making sacred sound. I'll see you there.
We're back with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Renee Komen, back with our guest, Mr. Paul Sanchez. Now, Paul, I know you're familiar with the way the show operates. This is a listener-supported operation. And we have PayPal and Venmo links there in the show notes of every show. Also on the Facebook page there, the posts we do to promote the show. Now, last show we had, someone had sent mail to the bar, and we had all those beautiful vintage postcards colorized, and they sent some couple of crisp $20 bills to buy our drinks last time. I think Manny might have converted his to something more I don't know.
Flocka!
Illicit, yeah. But this
you ever
week,
do flocka? It's crazy. Don't do it.
Okay. It's like right. those bath salts.
Stay
heavy,
away from
have you eaten somebody's face off?
Yeah. You don't want to be a zombie.
No. So this week we have shout outs for Michael Skankus, also Ryan O. Osipek, and also so they use the Venmo link. And I want to thank both of them for their not only their financial support, but their moral support, following the show for all these years. Also, a guy showed up in person at one of my gigs. I played a gig with Lynn Drury over there at the Old Point Bar. Fellow was sitting there and came over and started talking to me and said, "Oh, I'm a big fan of the podcast." And handed me some paper money, some folding money. So,
where's my cut?
Well, you're drinking it, Manny.
How much was this money?
Well, that was a $20 bill that the fellow handed me. So,
well, what's this guy's name?
Shout out to Danny Silverman. So appreciate that, Danny. Appreciate your patronage and following the show all these years. Thank them and, be like these fellas. If you're listening to the show, enjoying it, please, support the show. Also, we have a Patreon page there. We have a handful of patrons who are supporting the show week in and week out. Thank you so much. Follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars, costs you nothing, helps us a lot. What else? Oh, yeah, we have the Troubled Men podcast T-shirts, and our old buddy Arnie Skog sent me a picture of himself with his new Troubled Men podcast T-shirt. I'll be posting that at some point, but yes, he's a...
And he's wearing just a T-shirt.
Just the
Nothing
T-shirt.
Else.
Yeah.
That sounds like he would do something
like that. Have to blur
that
lower quarter out, but, but it's impressive. Anyway, that seems like enough of that. Back to our guest, the great Mr. Paul Sanchez. Now, Paul, we were talking that you were in the Backbeats there, but the Backbeats had dissolved. Vance DeGeneres had gone off to make his fortune in the TV business.
We did, like, we were going to move with him to L.A., me and Fred and John Herbert. And Vance was going to switch to bass because Steve had quit. And
Vance is a great bass player. Yeah. Vance being the bass player in the Cold.
And Ivan Neville was going to join on keyboard.
Okay.
And then while we were rehearsing and they were writing songs together, Vance did a reunion with the Cold that drew like 2,000 people, and they got back together.
Okay.
And the whole plan went out the window. And Ivan moved to L.A. without him, and Vance didn't go out there for another few years.
Oh, all right.
There was a great story that they were writing songs together in Ivan's place, and Vance told me, he said, like, Ivan was living with Aaron still, and he was 23 or 24, 23, and he had just started playing with the Neville Brothers doing some gigs, you know. And he said, Aaron walked in as they were writing a song, and he said, "Hey, Pop, we got to get some more gigs. I need some money." And he said, Aaron walked out without a word. And so Ivan goes, "Come with me, Vance." So they followed him into the next room. And he goes, "Hey, Pop, we got to get some gigs. I need some money." He said, Aaron walked out of the room without a word. Ivan tagged along after him, and Vance followed. He goes, "Hey, Pop." He said, Aaron turned on him and went, "You need some money? I hear they're hiring down on Julia Street Wharf."
That's good.
Now, I want to say how glad I am to be here, because I know I've listened to the show, and the guests are really very hip. Like Tiana was just on. She's very the hip artist.
Sure.
And my hip factor, I realize, has taken me a full 20 years to raise it back up from having been in cowboy mouth. Because like when Alex and I first started working together, 18 years ago,
Alex McMurray, yeah.
Alex
tell
McMurray
people what we're talking about.
Yeah, well, I met him because I was doing my first solo record after I left the mouth. And David, what's his name, from the band from Minneapolis, Perner, was producing. And we were doing a song of mine, and he goes, "Hey, man, this song needs some really nasty lead guitar." And I said, "Well, I don't really play Nasty Lee guitar. And he goes, well, I know a guy. And he goes next door at the truck farm, and he comes back with Alex, who I'd never met before. I'd heard about, of course. I never met him. And he'd been working in his garden. So he had, like, dirt on his face.
Uh-huh.
He had calamine lotion all over his arms because he'd gotten poison ivy working right in the garden. And his hair was, of course, standing straight up on his head because he was all sweaty, and that's what it does when you're sweaty. And he goes, hey, man. I said, hey. And David goes, I got this song I want you to play on, man. And he plays it for him, and he just slays it in one take. And Dave made him do a second one just in case he needed it. But then unplugged without a word, and I was like, wow, that was fucking brilliant.
Does Perner still live here?
Nah, he moved back a long time ago to Minneapolis.
Did he? I haven't seen him in a long time.
I think it's been over a decade since he's
been. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he just unplugged, and he went, thanks, man. I don't really get to do that kind of rock and roll too often. And split. And then I said, let me hire him for some gigs. And I started using him, and he could literally just do anything. Like, I know I have written 300 songs, but I know a couple of thousand. And I would start to test him and pull out obscure folk shit or whatever, and he would just do it. It would just be mind-blowingly fun. And I'd go to make some weird movie reference because I'd know every movie line ever, and he would finish the dialogue. So it became like this comedy act, you know. And at one point, some guy came up to me at DBA after a gig, and we never spoke. He'd get there, and I'd go, hey, man. He'd go, hey, man. We'd plug in, and then we'd tell jokes and riff all night, and then I'd give him money, and he'd split. And this guy walks up and goes, see, you guys must have been friends for a long time, right? I was like, no, like 6 months. We've never actually spoken off stage.
Explain to him that you're not friends. We're dear, dear colleagues.
And he turns to Alex and he goes, well, you should have him play Chess Fest. And before Alex could say anything, because I didn't want him to be uncomfortable, I went, oh, he can't, you know, because I was in cowboy mouth, so my hip factor is out the window, and I'm not even allowed in the marinade. There's nothing really he can do about it. And the guy looked at Alex kind of confused and went, Alex? And Alex went, no, seriously, man, there's nothing I can do.
Those are the rules. So let's get into cowboy mouth. So you and Fred LeBlanc, the drummer, are in the Backbeats together. And
Fred got in Dash and had a nice run. He was on 688 Records, so he had made an album, which was really cool to me. And, of course, I think Bill's one of the great Southern Gothic
Bill Davis,
writers.
Yes,
you know, he's like the Flannery O'Connor with a slashing guitar.
Right.
He's a great lyricist. And
great front man, too.
He's a brilliant rock and roller, right?
Yeah.
He's a great front man and all that stuff. But, like, I never forget seeing Bill at Jed's play an acoustic set. He had just flown home from his grandfather's funeral, and he did an acoustic version of Big Daddy Like Whiskey that was slowed down and had been written about his grandfather. Old Crow is his elixir of life, but it cuts him up just like a Bowie knife. And it was incredibly moving and powerful. You know, it was a beautiful thing to do in memory of his grandfather. So I had a lot of respect for him as a writer. And I'd gone on to work on movies. I was living in Boston working on a TV series, the first one ever on Fox.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was called Against the Law. It starred Michael O'Keefe from Caddyshack.
Wow.
It was on the air for, I think, 3.5 episodes. I think they canceled it in the middle of the fourth episode.
Like, the critics called it everything from shit to fucking shit, right?
You saw it.
Yeah.
That was the show.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was living in Boston and working as a PA, making $500 a week in 1990. And Fred called and said, hey, man, I got a deal with Capitol Records, and I'm going to be making a record in Geneva, Wisconsin, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Would you want to come and play on it? And go touring. And I was... been working on movies for about 2 years at that point, and I thought, man, sounds fun to be in a band again. So I go to my boss and I say, hey, Daniel. Daniel Loopy was the unit manager who now works with Steven Spielberg. And I said, hey, man, I got this offer to go play on a record for Guy's Got a Record Deal, and I want to leave. And he goes, I was covered my own place. He goes, well, tell you what, Paul, if you stay, I'll give you a free place to stay on the Charles River here in Boston, and I'd really like to keep you. So I go back to my immediate boss, the AD, Alan Breton, who I'm still friends with 30-something years later, and I go, hey, man, Daniel offered me a free place. And he goes, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. So I thought about it, and at lunch I went back. I said, nah, man, I really want to play music. He goes, if you stay, I'll double your salary, and I'll give you the free place. I was like, wow.
For a PA? They're doing this for a PA?
They liked me.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, wow. So I waited till the end of the day, and I turned him down, and I went back to Alan, and I said, hey, man. He goes, what'd you say? I said, man, I hate to leave you in a lurch, but I really want to play music. I turned him down. And he goes, good. You're supposed to be playing music. If you'd have stayed, I'd have punched you right in your fucking face.
Okay.
So I met Fred. I drove like 3 days to Lake Geneva from Boston. I arrived there, and he gives me a hug and says, hey, man, my A&R guy got fired, and I got dropped. So there's no record deal. And I just quit my job, and
there's no cell phones or anything. No, can't tell you this while you're on
right,
the road.
No, you couldn't tell me till I got there, you know. And so he goes, you know, can you get your job back? I said, I'm pretty sure I can. He goes, well, if you want to start a band, I'm pretty sure I can get us gigs. So we decided to start a band, and I found out later he was bullshit and he didn't know how he was going to get gigs. And we kind of stunk. He was trying to do it like Dash. He wanted to be a bass player and us. But I'm not that guitar player. You know, I'm a rhythm guitar player primarily. And we stunk pretty bad for about a month, and then he left a message on my machine saying, hey, man, what about John Thomas Griffith on lead guitar? And I was elated.
From the Red Rockers.
Yeah, and the John Thomas Griffith solo band. And plus, Griff somehow found out a few years earlier that I was a big fan of old country songs. Mm. And I was standing outside of Jimmy's at a packed Red Rocker show, and he walks up and he goes, dude, like he does, dude, I hear you know a lot of old country songs. Let's get together. I really want to learn some. And I was like starstruck going, oh, okay. And he walks away. And my buddy turns to me, goes, man, you know John Thomas Griffith? And I said, no. But we got together and I taught him a bunch of old country. So when Fred suggested him, I was really pleased because he sings high and I sing low.
Right.
And I just loved working
right.
with him.
And you guys got Steve Walters to play.
First, it was a guy named Paul Clement who plays
Paul Clement. Sure,
with Woodenhead.
Yeah.
And Paul was really wanted to do it. And I'd known him since he was 17, but he was really wanted to get his degree in music therapy. Where he eventually met his wife, and that was his whole life. So he only
playing music while on a couch or something. Music
I
therapy.
I think so.
What the fuck does that even mean?
Which, in that case, I've been a music therapist.
Yeah.
He left after 6 months, and that's when we got Steve. Steve had quit playing music for about 10 years by that point.
Right.
He was living in Mississippi, painting signs for a living.
Okay.
But I just had a feeling he wanted to play again. And we went out there to give him a shot, and he said, yeah, I'd be interested. And he took the bass out of the case, and he hadn't played it in 10 years, and it had rust on the strings.
Yeah.
And we all started laughing. He goes, if you think that's funny, what do you hear my playing? But he just rocked. And the first gig we did in Austin at the Hole in the Wall, it's like it holds about 100 people, and we probably had 125 in there. It was just packed wall to wall. And the stage is 5 inches off the floor, so the audience is right in your face. And Steve's bouncing off the walls. He's so happy and ferocious to be playing again. Right. He's punking out on stage, and he keeps bouncing his back off the wall. And what he doesn't know is there's a nail, and he stabbed himself repeatedly.
That's punk rock, baby.
Punk rock. Well, you know, we did a show. We got to do a tour in France. Some guy saw us in New York. I mean, we're making no money. We're making $100 a show, but we get a gig in New York, and this promoter in France sees us, and he flies us over for a festival called Trans Musicale in Rennes, France, which you only get to play once in your career. Bands from around the world. So we meet him at the airport, and he goes, Cowboy Mouse? I said, yeah. And he goes, you are one of the mice? I was like, whatever. You know, so we get there, and you get to play your one gig, but you're there for the whole 3 days, and you get free meals, and you get to see other bands for free. Well, the Buzzcocks were playing at a small club, and Griff and Steve, being old punks, really wanted to see the Buzzcocks.
Sure.
So they go to the show, and a riot breaks out, punk rock style, which in perfect fashion, Steve stands there smiling as shit goes flying by his head. Griff dives behind the merch counter and is peeking over the top of the counter.
Right.
And so afterwards, the Buzzcocks are signing autographs.
Because he had been on MTV. So
didn't want to hurt the face.
Yeah.
And they're signing autographs, and this French chick's there, and the guy, the lead singer, goes, you're quite beautiful, actually. Would you like to come back to the hotel, have a drink? And she goes, but I thought you were married. And he goes, yeah, it's quite sad, actually. She's leaving. In fact, she's already left.
Oh, man.
You know, Dave Clemens stuck his face in here because this is his joint.
Yes, yeah.
And I just want to say I was a huge fan of the Rockabies. I don't know.
Rockabies, sure.
Did you see him?
Absolutely.
It was
Bobby
Cranston
Brennan.
And Dave Clemens.
Right.
With many different drummers. And the act was rockabilly, hardcore rockabilly, which made you dance your ass off. But they also, of course, Cranny had to stop shows just to tell jokes.
Yeah, well, and the Clemens brothers are famous for their horrible jokes.
And when Dave didn't laugh, Cranny would just go, you're fired as my brother.
Yeah.
It was great fun. And I mean, he's just such a great bass player. But my favorite Dave Clement story is they had a gig outside of New Orleans, and Cranny was telling me when they got back, it was his car, and Dave, he was tired, so Dave said he'd drive. And he said, I started hearing the engine sound funny somewhere past Baton Rouge. I said, Dave, engine sounds funny, don't you think? And he goes, no, we're fine, bro. He says about a half hour later, the engine blew because he was driving in...
In second?
yeah. God. Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot of drag.
A lot of drag.
That reminds me when I first moved here like 20 years ago, I had met this guy, and we actually came here.
Oh, my God.
Had some drinks, and he lived in Kenner. And I was living on Plum Street, but he was too fucked up. I said, I'll drive you home.
Oh, my God.
In Kenner.
That's a haul.
And I'll keep your car and drive back here. I'll just crash at your place. And I didn't know where I was going because I wasn't familiar. And we ended up in Gonzales.
Whoa. That's awesome.
Before he woke up and says, where the hell are you?
I don't know.
I have no idea where we are. You know. Oh my God.
Well, I got hired on a movie in New Orleans that was called Beyond the Groove, which is an incredible experience. It was a made-for-television British film that had a very loose plot. The guy who was the star of The Wizard, the midget, I can't remember, it was David something. Shoot, I can't remember his name.
The but midget?
He was a midget, yeah.
Peter Dinklage?
Not that guy. This was years ago. This is the 80s. He was a star on NBC, the show The Wizard. Oh, and anyway, okay. He's the star of the film. He plays a banker who comes out of his house and finds a 67 Cadillac convertible in his driveway that takes him on a magical mystery tour of American rock and roll artists.
Oh.
So they shot Aaron Neville and Dr. John here. And the Dr. John day, of course, I was 29 years old. So, there was never... Not a time when there was a Dr. John for you too, I'm sure. You know,
sure,
like high school, I'm listening to Such a Night. And so I'm on the set, and Mac was in Ringo's All Star Band, you know, playing a gig in Japan. So he plays the gig in Japan. He flies to New York, does a Today Show in the morning, and then comes to New Orleans for 10 o'clock to be in this movie. He's done.
Right.
He's in his stage clothes. He's exhausted. He arrives on set. And they go, anybody want to go check on Mac, see if he needs anything? And I'm like, yeah, please, 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 please. So I go knock on his door, and I hear him go, yeah. And I open the door. He didn't even open his eyes. He's just sitting there like this with his hands on his belly like the hippest Buddha there ever was. And he goes, I go, hey, Mac, you need anything? He goes, nah, I might. And I go to leave, and he opens his eyes. He goes, hey, my old lady wanted me to take the dog to the vet. Somebody call her, tell her I ain't got time for that shit. I said, yeah, man, I'll get somebody on that. So I went and told the AD, and he said, I'll get somebody to call his wife. And so then I'm standing outside of his dressing room with the walkie, and the wardrobe and the second AD start getting in a conversation about where's his fishing outfit, because it's on Lake Pontchartrain by the old fishing camps on Hain, right. And he's going to be fishing. And they said, well, we don't have one. We thought he was from Louisiana. He didn't know how to dress for a fishing scene. And I go, what the fuck are you talking about? Your wardrobe, you got to have a fishing... Well, he's a big guy. Back then, he was pretty heavy. And they go, sure. We don't have anything that big. And there's this argument going on, and this cursing begins, and Mac opens his eyes. He goes, hey, you tell him the doctor always dresses like the doctor.
Okay.
So he does the bit in his stage clothes. And at the end of the scene, they go, who wants to take him back to the hotel? I was like, please, please, please.
All right.
And at the time, I had a 77 LTD with a giant two-tone blue and white vinyl and the opera windows.
Yeah. Nice.
And he hops in. I turn on the car, and OZ's on, of course, naturally. And again, he doesn't say a word, hands on the belly like the Buddha, eyes closed. And Ariane comes on by Aaron Neville. And he goes, still eyes closed, he goes, oh, man, turn this up. I ain't heard this since the day we recorded. And he listens for a while, and still has got his eyes closed. He goes, man, I remember the day we recorded this shit. Aaron had laryngitis or some shit. One of the brothers mixed him up some herbal shit. Smelled like crap. He drank it down in one big gulp. Sang this in one take. And he closed his eyes, laid back, listened to it, smiled and went, Aaron Neville and Johnny Adams. After that, the list gets mighty fucking short.
Yeah.
And the song finished, and he opened his eyes one last time and went, Aaron Neville, he fries my ass.
Well, I remember the only Dr. John story I have is at least 20 years ago when I used to jog on the bayou. I used to actually do walking and jogging on the bayou. I remember jogging on Bayou St. John. It must have been 2002 or something. And I saw all these people who, dog walkers, you know, women on the bayou eating lunch. And they all were like parting like the Red Sea because Dr. John was driving.
Oh, wow.
And they were scared out of their fucking lives because he was such a fucking, you know, he was fuck up. Everyone was just parting like the Red Sea. He's driving. Get out of the way.
Oh, my God.
Get out of the way. He's driving. And it was, and I, you know, I didn't know much about it, you know, but I got the fuck out of here. And you see this guy, he's like a lowrider, but not in a lowrider, you know. He's below the steering wheel, and he's doing like, you know, 20 miles an hour.
Oh, my God.
He can't see the fuck the road. So it was crazy going nuts, you know,
oh,
and people, thank God he didn't kill anyone, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
More than that occasion, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But that movie took me out to L.A., because we were talking about you not knowing where you were in New Orleans, and so they said, well, do you want to come to L.A. with us? I go, yeah. They go, do you know L.A.? Oh, yeah, yeah, I've been to L.A. Never been to L.A. in my life. So the first day, they send me up to Laurel Canyon to pick up the star, and the shooting in Griffith Park, and I got to be there for like 4:30 in the morning. I didn't have a Thomas guide. I just followed Laurel Canyon Boulevard to Griffith Park, which was kind of windy. Maybe it wasn't even that. Some road from his house went there if I just stayed on it, but it took a lot
again?
Of turns. David, can't remember his last name now. I have to look it up. I'll let you know. He was a show called The Wizard. He was also in Time Bandits.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah.
So I gave him a ride there, and I got yelled at when I got there, but he liked me, and he took up for me and said, leave me alone. So they said, all right, then, Paul. They were pissed. They said, take these pages back to the office. It's on La Jolla.
Yeah, being a PA sucks.
So they give me directions to the office.
Yeah.
And now it's about a half-hour ride that's turned into about an hour.
Yeah.
And I'm stopping at a payphone because there's no cell phones. I'm like, look, you got to help me, man. Y'all gave me directions and they're not working. Every time I get to the street you told me to take a left on, La Jolla isn't there. It's some street called La Jolla. And they started laughing like you're laughing now. And they went, that's great, Paul. When you get to La Jolla, take a left and it'll lead you right to us. And we'll explain about how well you know L.A.
And your last name is Sanchez. So
they're fucking with you big time, man. I remember one time I was dating this girl in L.A., Nancy Steiner, a wardrobe artist, award-winning wardrobe artist. She did the wardrobe for Lost in Translation.
Oh, I love it.
I knew her from high school, but we dated off and on. And she had this weird kind of like L.A., New York, Jewish accent. And she kept saying, Manny, the party's on 2847 Venice. So me and my friend Dick Root are looking for 2847 Venice Boulevard.
Right.
Venice Boulevard. We can't find 2847 Venice Boulevard. We're going all over the West Side. We're going back and forth. We realized that with her little slang, she meant Van Ness.
Van Ness.
Oh, no. Oh, wow.
So we spent 2 hours.
Oh, my God.
And dealing with people's road rage because we were like circling back
course,
and stuff
yeah.
like that. This is L.A. in like the mid-80s. And it was Van Ness.
Oh, my God.
It was like I got to that party and I was so angry with her that we made out. Really cool.
There you go.
Okay. There we go. Yeah. Anyway, that's a long story. It's long ago. You know, it's another lifetime.
Sure,
yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Less left the narrative when Cowboy Mouth is just starting. Now, you guys went through a whole bunch of different bass players over this
we
whole
did.
Course. But
you know,
we were talking before we started the show about late 90s, early 2000s, and how Cowboy Mouth, also the Iguanas at that time, doing, you know, 250 dates a year. It's like, how did you get through all these dates? But
you know, like
crack.
Your band was taken off the same time that we were taken off. I was a big fan of the Iguanas, and really, I thought your records were so great. And there was a lot of things I didn't like about being Cowboy Mouth, but there was things that I wouldn't trade for anything. Like in the early days, when we were just making like $100 a gig, we got an offer to open up for Bo Diddley in Charlotte, North Carolina, for $100, and to be his backing band for an extra $150.
Oh, nice.
$150 makes a difference.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So we played in
each
Jack's.
Play with Bo.
Right?
Is that each or just for the
whole band? No, that was for the whole band.
Band.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
But $150 was real money in those
days.
That
was real money back then. And so, like, we played in Jackson, Mississippi at a double wide trailer.
Oh, wow.
I forget the name of the bar, but it was a double wide. And $100, and then drove the 16 hours to Charlotte to play for Bo. So we're on stage, we do our sound check, and the place holds like 3,000 people, and we'd never played for that kind of crowd before. And Bo walks in, and it's, you know, three scruffy-looking punk rockers, and he literally just shakes his head, four scruffy-looking punk rockers, and shakes his head down like, oh, man, four white boys. And he pulls his square guitar out of the case, plugs it in without a word to us, doesn't tell us what song he's playing, doesn't tell us what key it is, but Fred and I were huge Bo fans. So as soon as he started singing, we looked at each other and we're right there.
Right.
And so we were supposed to, we did a pretty rock, and he did, I think maybe song and a half or sound check, and he waves us off. He goes, he finally smiles. He goes, all right, we're going to have some fun tonight.
Oh, nice.
So then the promoter, who's probably 21, comes up really nervous and goes, Mr. Diddley, we have a reservation for you in the finest restaurant in Charlotte. He goes, restaurant? I ain't going to no restaurant. And the guy gets shook. He goes, well, but Mr. Diddley, it says here in your contract you have to be provided dinner. He goes, that's right. I want some Church's fried chicken in my hotel room. So he goes back and he watches our set. And he gets pissed because we were rocking. We like turned the place on fire because we were pretty good when we were young. We sucked later, but we were really good when we were young.
Yeah.
And but then he comes up on stage and we were rocking just as hard for him. And
right.
He was supposed to play 90 minutes. He did 2 hours.
Wow,
it was just
man.
Big fun. And afterwards, he's backstage sweating. He goes, boy, I like you boys. I'm going to give you some advice. Keep it simple and think of Church.
Think okay. Of Church's fried chicken? Or think of Church?
Yeah, that would have been great. I never made that connection until now. Yeah, thank
man,
you, man.
Away.
You know what? He might have actually said, keep it simple and think of Churches, and I didn't hear it. I wanted it to be a more poetic moment, so I only heard the Church.
Churches is okay, chicken. It's all right.
Bo liked it.
Yeah,
and Bo knows chicken.
The
Bo
community
knows.
Carlo
Nucci always said Church's was better than Popeye's. He always swore to that.
Yeah,
to me.
No, that's their popular.
And Carlo knew a lot about a lot of things.
Yeah.
I have a song on one of my records called Drive Right Back to You, and the line is, Vance wrote the lyrics, and it's, I'll walk the Sahara, beg, steal a Barra to drive right back to you. So we're in the studio recording a song, and I play it for Carlo, and he goes, Paul, really? Sahara and Barra? I said, well, Vance wrote the song, and he went, oh, I get it then.
Oh, man. Carlo, I miss him.
Oh, man.
I miss the money he owes me.
Yeah.
That's what I miss.
Well, I tell you what, as a drummer, like when I did a few records with Carlo, but the first one I did, a buddy of mine, the Chris Joseph, who did Threadhead Records and made a lot of records for a lot of artists, got sick. And he was going to Germany for some experimental treatments and was trying to get a record done in like 3 days' time before he split with some songs that he'd written with me and Alex. And so I knew that Matt Perrine and Alex would do anything Carlos said because they were just used to listening to him.
Yeah.
So I hired him on drums. And I walk in the studio, and they're all there, and Matt and Carlo are huddled in conversation. They stop talking as soon as I walk in, so I know they're talking about me. And Matt nods at Carlo like, you got to say something. And Carlo goes, all right, what do you want on this first song? I said, well, what do you feel like playing? He goes, I got like 15 different ideas. I said, well, pick your favorite one and go with it. And he goes, I get to pick the groove. I said, yeah, well, you're the drummer. He goes, all right. So we get in the studio, and I said, hey, man, I really wanted him to take control because I knew they would just listen to him, and I didn't have time.
Right.
I said, hey, man, I get kind of nervous in the studio, and I tend to count off fast. Would you count off the songs, too?
Mm.
And he crosses his arms, sits back on his stool, and goes, let me get this straight. I'm going to pick the groove, and I'm going to count it off. I said, yeah. He goes, all right. He turns to Matt. He goes, what are you playing? Matt goes, I don't know. I haven't heard it yet. And I said, yeah, I thought I'd just play it for you guys. And I play it. And Carlo goes, all right, Matt, do this. Don't come in till the second verse. Alex, come in here, do this. And they just both went, all right. And that was it, man. We cut a whole record in one day because Carlo told everybody what to do, and they just did it.
Right. Well, you know, so on this topic, You know, Alex hired Carlo to be the drummer in Royal Finger Bowl, you know. And it's Alex's band. He, you know, not the first drummer. Kevin O'Day being the first drummer. And, you know, Carlo comes in as a... But then, you know, they play for a couple of years. And I run into Alex one day, and I was like, hey, Alex, how's it going, man? He goes, you know, just working for the Nooch.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, Paul, you know, I had so many notes here, and we didn't get to hardly any of them. Well, we got to some of them. We you know, might have to have you back for a part two to
maybe the anniversary show next year or something.
Yeah, well,
like
wait. You know, actually, this is show 299.
Oh,
almost monumental.
So, yeah. Well, no, it's the first show of the year. It's the last show of this cycle.
That is monumental, then. Thank you.
Know, absolutely.
It's all perspective, as life often is.
Yeah. And so the next one, we're coming up on Manny's break. The semester at school is starting next week.
Yeah, I can't do a show
week.
For a few weeks.
So yeah, we're going to have a couple of weeks off. Yeah, we'll plan something big for episode 300.
Yeah.
We'll let y'all know where that is. Maybe we'll have a whole
maybe we'll have
omnibus
a food truck
thing.
Here. Like
food truck. We'll have all the guests from the past 300 shows, past 299 shows show up and check in with us. But, Paul, we have so much more to get to, but you have so much more. I know you had some voice issues. Those are all resolved now at this point. We'll go into
it's
detail
better. It's,
next
it's a work
time.
In progress always, as it's life always is.
Sure. It sounds good, man. It's a nice resonance.
Hey, man, for 4 months I couldn't speak at all, and then for 2 years it was a rasp. So
that was
to be
your
able to do this
best
is great.
4 months ever, right?
She's a champ. She's a champ.
Yeah.
She took me when I was falling apart and put me back together.
All right.
It's
a struggle, man.
I had to have spine surgery. My voice stopped working. I slept in an easy chair for about 6 months, and I couldn't do anything. I couldn't walk. And she came home from New Year's Eve party with her family, and I had laid some rose petals on the ground. I said, when I get these surgeries and get well, would you marry me? And she said, I'll marry you now and help you get well.
Oh.
And she took care of me and helped me get well. And now it's going to be 8 years together and 6 years married in March.
That's wonderful, man. Congratulations. And she's
a sweet story.
A great New Orleans girl, real... tried and true.
We worked together
girl.
When we were 19 with Marion when she was 16.
Yeah, but you married a twin, so how do you know who you're really married to?
They don't look anything alike to me. I'm always surprised when people say they look
because
alike.
Because you're on medication.
Well, always.
Yeah, well, then how do you know? They might be fucking with you.
Every day of their lives.
Yeah, I bet
all
so.
Right.
Every day of their lives.
Those twins, they
those
like to
twins.
Play that game.
Like
yeah,
The Shining,
yeah, yeah.
Man.
No, her sister's the good twin, and her my brother-in-law Eric calls Allison the evil twin.
Okay.
Well, before we leave, news on the horizon on the Paul Sanchez universe.
Yes.
In the Paul Sanchez universe. I know you've been working on a record, jazz record with Shamar Allen.
Yes. I got a grant from the Threadhead Foundation.
Okay.
And Shamar is producing, and we've gotten 3 tracks done and are going to do more hopefully this week. The band is his son, Jarrell, on drums, who plays with Delfeo Marsalis' band.
Delfeo, yeah.
Delfeo. And then Cam Watson, who's Jamal Watson's son. Jamal played with me 15 years ago on the Rolling Road show. He's a great drummer. And Cam's on keyboards. He's amazing. And a young man named Javier on bass. All three of them are 19, still in school at Loyola.
All right.
And just brilliant.
Okay.
And so Shamar just tells them, they discuss groove, and I just sing. I play them demos, which... Unfortunately, they ignore my playing.
So it's free labor for you, right?
Oh, no, I'm paying.
Oh, you're paying big time? Okay.
Not big time, but I'm paying them. I'm paying like they're pros because they are. You know, I'm giving them pro rate.
But they're students still, right?
Yeah, but better than a lot of guys I've paid.
If you want. If you wanted to, you could rip
I don't know.
Them
if, he, if he's working for Marsalis, he probably knows that he's... He probably
now,
makes
I don't know who Marsalis is.
We had
Marsalis
Delfeo
Watson.
On,
he was in...
We had Delfeo on the show during the
did
lockdown.
Did we really?
Yeah, he was remote.
You didn't see Pulp Fiction?
It was
I did
Marsalis.
See Paul, one of the worst movies ever.
Marsalis. Yeah.
Sam L. Jackson.
Marsalis was Ving Rhames, I think.
Ving Rhames. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
You recorded
now you know
with
who Marsalis
him.
Is.
Gimp. Yeah.
You know who Marsalis is.
He's the guy who got raped by the white supremacists.
The Gimp. Yeah.
No.
And you recorded with him.
No, that's a different Marsalis.
Oh, okay. All right.
Anyway, so yeah, Shamar's producing, and he knows jazz, and he's having fun working with his son and these young men, and the songs sound wonderful. It's great to hear real jazz players playing songs I've written.
Nice.
When I couldn't sing, I didn't know how to play piano, but Allison bought me one because she didn't want me to get frustrated that my voice wasn't working. So I taught myself to play piano and learned like Cole Porter and Hoagy Carmichael songs because that's what Frank Sinatra sang, and I love those songs since I was a kid. And once I learned about 24 of them and learned how the chords worked, way more complicated chords than I'd known from rock and roll, which took me a long time to get, but I was like, oh, wow, they use a lot of the same progressions. It's kind of like rock and roll in that they follow a sort of
pattern.
So I just started writing songs in that style and really wanted to record with real jazz players.
So that's a work in progress, and that'll be coming out sometime in the
spring. Shamar's producing Cyril Neville's new record.
Nice.
So he's trying to finish Cyril and then finish me and then his own.
And you'll be finished.
I will be finished.
Good.
Danny. I will be finished.
And this show's over.
Yes. Well, Paul, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's been a great episode and lots of good stories. And,
thanks for the laugh and troubling times.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. The Trouble Nation knows what to do.
We like to say on the Trouble Men podcast that trouble never ends.
But the struggle continues. Good night.
Good night.
Walking in Liverpool, that's where it all began. I'm following the footsteps of my heroes and my friends. Walking in Liverpool, I'm singing to myself. Listening to the cobblestones for stories they might tell. And I'm dragging used-to-bes along with me. 'Cause in New Orleans, change don't come easily. Still I'm glad to be standing on Matthew Street. Who knows what ghosts I'll meet walking in Liverpool. Feeling like a kid. I don't know how I got here, and I'm happy that I did. Walking in Liverpool, boy can't help but dream. This town is full of heroes, and this place ain't what it seems. Walking in Liverpool, I'm doing all I can. I feel there's something special on its way to where I am. And while I try my best to keep my mind at ease, in Liverpool, your dreams don't come easily. So I hold on to every single thing I see. When my hope starts to leave this street, walking in Liverpool is where I'm meant to be. Time will surely tell us, you know I can't wait and see. Walking in Liverpool, as I trace my father's steps, I see a million faces wishing I was somewhere else. Walking in Liverpool, she's heavy on my mind, and I'm afraid to face the morning, afraid what I might find. As I struggle to work out my destiny in Liverpool, change don't come easily. And this fear that I hold down deep inside of me will probably end up killing me. Walking in Liverpool, and I'm feeling so alone. I'm wondering how I got here and if I can make it home. Walking in Liverpool, walking in Liverpool.